I won't pull this open. Maybe before we get started, Jordan, can you pray for us?
Thanks, Jenny. Yeah, God, just thanks that we're all able to meet tonight like this together. I just pray that you would work through Jenny and that you would help us to focus and stir up some good discussion on what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Sweet. Amen. Thank you. All right, here we go. Let me see if I can make this go away from the beginning. All right. Everybody can see my screen, I'm sure, right? Can you see me? Thank you. Thanks, Riley. Can you, because last time it turns out I turned my camera off. Is that true? Okay. Here we go. Let me do one more thing here. Okay. So the topic tonight is, does science contradict the Bible? It is a monstrous topic. There's all sorts of writings, you know, from Christian writings to scientist writings to the new atheists. There's just all sorts of information and books and everything on this topic. So just had to select through it a little bit to pick and choose. And I'm sure this will only touch on some things and hopefully, like Jordan prayed, it could open up more conversation. So the question is, does science contradict the Bible? You have differing opinions on this. So you have Christians or theists that say yes or no. We're going to look at a few quotes from some very accomplished scientists. Most of them are still alive. And you'll see that there's people on either side of this. So some of these are going to be atheists. Some of these are going to be theists. I think we have four or so quotes. Before we understand science, it's natural to believe that God created the universe. But now science offers a more convincing explanation. The universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason why there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. And that's from Stephen Hawking, who was a very accomplished theoretical physicist, was well on his way probably to getting a Nobel Prize. His emphasis in research was black holes. He was an avowed atheist, although I don't know if he did anything there at the end in an exchange with God. But he did die in 2018. So you got Stephen Hawking there, speaking on the atheistic side. Let me get a few of you up on the screen. I don't see many. Hold on. There. Maybe this next one somebody else could read. How about Nina? Could you read that one?
Yeah. Why do I believe in God? I see an orderly, beautiful universe in which nearly all physical phenomena can be understood from a few simple mathematical equations. I see a universe that, had it been constructed slightly differently, would never have given birth to stars and planets, let alone bacteria and people. And there's no good scientific reason for why the universe should not have been different. Many good scientists have concluded from these observations that an intelligent God must have chosen to create the universe with such beautiful, simple, and life-giving properties. Many other equally good scientists are nevertheless atheists. Both conclusions are positions of faith.
Okay. So that's William Phillips. He was a Nobel Prize winner some time ago for trapping atoms with laser light. But I thought it was interesting. He's from Wilkes-Barre, PA. So, and he is still alive. He's got the opposite viewpoint there of Hawking's. Of Hawking, he's saying that that there was a creator in the mathematical equations and how the constants and the things within the universe follow an orderly pattern is evidence that there must be a God. So here's two people that take totally different views. One of them says that the universe creates itself, whereas this guy's position is that God created the universe. Both of them, he argues, are positions of faith, which I think we'll all have to agree with, right? Who was there in the beginning? I wasn't. I may be old, but I was not there. And I bet you weren't either. So next, let's see. How about John?
A supernatural creator almost certainly does not exist. and that belief in a personal God qualifies as a delusion.
Okay, this is a summary of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, that he's a pretty aggressive atheist that feels like it is his responsibility to tear down theology and get rid of God, and the world will be a lot better that way. So this is just a summary of that book. There's lots of other things in that book. I think he writes to inflame, but I think that's why he's so appealing to people as well. So The God Delusion. And then the last one here, Corinne, could you get that?
Think of science as a gift from the creator. The curiosity that we have been instilled with to understand how the universe works can inspire even greater awe of the creator. This gift could hardly be a threat to God, the author of it all. The God of the Bible is the God of the genome.
Francis Collins, fascinating guy, used to lead, he was the director of the Human Genome Project. And I believe when that was, it's not fully complete. Certainly the genome is, so they're still working there. And now he's the director of NIH. So all you guys that are doing research are probably getting some portion of your funding from his Institute of Health, NIH. I know that we're on the verge of lots more funding there soon. But this guy is fascinating. He's the one that wrote the book called The Language of God as he was completing his work there with the Human Genome Project. And it's just, he's got some fascinating writing. Very convinced Christian and not afraid to talk about it. So kind of cool. So tonight we're going to look at does science contradict the Bible? And we're going to look at three things. One, we're going to take a look at how modern science was actually founded on a belief in God. Secondly, how science in the Bible, instead of contradict, they actually complement one another. And I think increasingly we're going to see more and more of that. And lastly, how apparent contradictions between science and the Bible are resolved. I'm only going to go through two of them. There's probably plenty that we could do. But I do say apparent contradictions because I don't hold, and many don't hold, that they are actually contradictions. So before we go to the next slide I just went to, this is the first point will be modern science was founded on a belief in God. And I just wanted to look at what unmodern science looked like. Okay, so here's unmodern science. This is prior to the Enlightenment. Doing very strange things. Bloodletting, big deal. I don't know many people that still do that now. Maybe there's some up there in Idaho. I don't know. But then also, look at this other one. What is this? Let's chop the top of this woman's head off and try to see what she's thinking. Who knows what that is? But we all have our things we've seen in horror movies and everything of medieval science, which wasn't science at all. The whole scientific method hadn't even been created at that point. Or developed. So modern science, first we'll do how it's originated and founded by a belief in God. I keep trying to move this panel out of my way. It's like having a dog that's always under your feet. Drives you crazy. Okay, wait. Here we go. Let's go back up. Modern science was developed in the 16th and 17th century in Europe. Pretty much that was the time during the Enlightenment when we see this whole thing about modern science and the development of the scientific method, which is, you know, observation, and then you make a hypothesis and you test your hypothesis and you see the results and then you try to formulate a theory if you did anything effective there. It's interesting that it developed in Europe, which was really at that point a culture that had a biblical worldview. A lot was going on in China at the same time, and as well in the Islamic world, and they were very far advanced in some technology kind of things. But the difference here is, what else do I want to say? And academia, super invested in academia. But modern science was developed in the milieu of Europe during this period. Next. It was grounded in a belief in an all-powerful creator God. Most of the early pioneers, the founders of so many areas of modern science, were either Christian or theists. Part of it being the impetus for modern science is that they believe that God had a blueprint for creation, and he designed us with minds to discover that blueprint. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He says, during that time, men became scientists because they expected laws in nature, and they expected laws in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. Same, just a C.S. Lewis way to say the same thing, that they, the impetus for doing science was, as Johannes Kepler said, it's thinking God's thoughts after him. It's coming to understand what he's put here and using the faculties that he's given us to really understand what is the blueprint. Kind of a fascinating beginning. I didn't know that. Or at least if I did learn it, I certainly didn't remember that until recently. So just look at just a few of the early scientists. You know, there's all sorts of names you'll recognize because a lot of them have laws based around things that they discovered. Kepler did the laws of planetary motion, right? He felt that he would, a lot of these guys wrote as well. They were theologians, they wrote, they were scientists, they were doing both. And he said that I wanted to come to fully understand, he called it the geometry of God. Bacon discovered Bacon, which was super cool, and also sort of solidified that scientific method and popularized it. And so it's the thing people started picking up and realizing we can do real science, we can experiment, we can understand things. He wrote a ton of theological essays. He was recognized probably more for that than some of the other stuff during his lifetime. Boyle's Law, if you know that, that's the one about gases, the inverse relationship between pressure and volume in a gas. I'm citing one thing that some of these guys came up with. They're, you know, for some of them, they were like Da Vinci men. They had a lot of stuff they were looking at the same time. But Boyle was interesting because he was a super serious, an evangelist in a sense that he communicated about the love of God in Christ. And so people recognized him as that. He was also a very serious Bible translator in the middle of developing his laws and all that. It's just phenomenal to see some of the work that was accomplished. Isaac Newton, gravity, right? Mathematician, physicist, astronomer, and a serious theologian. Isaac Newton was a serious theologian. And after he came up with the laws of gravitation, he wrote that he was seriously hoping to convince people, to convince thinking people that there was a God. And so in a lot of these cases, you see these were the goals. People were examining what God had created as they viewed it and looking for the order in the patterns and found them. Certainly some of them, right? Okay, next. Science in the Bible, this is the next point, they complement one another. They fit together. I think this slide, we're going to be talking about how there's not this big disconnect between science and the Bible. And, you know, I understand back in the day when I was an atheist and I didn't know anything about the Bible and hadn't thought very deeply, I thought there are plenty of contradictions. And yet from this side, I realized there's a lot of harmony between what I have learned as a scientist and what scientists have learned. Well, beyond me, obviously, but it's not science and the Bible that are in conflict, but there is something that is in conflict. Let me see again. It's something called scientism, which I didn't realize that it was a philosophy that I had bought into in my atheist years. And scientism is a philosophy. It is not a science. It holds to these positions that science is the only way to truth, and that science can eventually explain everything. And that is a statement of philosophy That is not a scientific statement. You can't go into a lab and reproduce anything to try to find out if that's true. That is, those are philosophical statements. Along with that is really sort of the naturalistic thinking that the only things that are really real are the things I can access with my five senses and test with my five senses. But again, recognize this is a philosophical statement. And in fact, John Lennox, who's a theoretical mathematician and Christian thinker, he makes the point with this that the statement science is the only way to truth is really self. Well, I guess that's in my notes here. It's self-contradicting. That is a self-contradicting statement, because if it's true that science is the only way to truth, and that statement is philosophical, then that statement is false. So if it's true, then it's false. And it is kind of nonsense. If you think about it, what is your support? What is the support of scientism for that statement? I mean, I believed that for many years, that science was the way to truth, that ultimately science will explain everything in the universe. But I think in order to make those kind of bold philosophical statements from more than just faith, you have to know everything. How do I know that science is the only way to truth? Wouldn't that imply that I have looked into, read, understood every other thing there is to be understood in the universe to make a bold statement like that? So it's got all sorts of issues, but the issue here is that philosophy of scientism does obviously contradict the biblical worldview. It certainly does contradict the biblical worldview. Because, I mean, think about it. It's the biblical worldview holds that there is a God, that there is heaven, that people have intrinsic value because they're made in the image of God. I mean, just name all the things. Scientism excludes anything that has to do with the biblical worldview, or actually most things. This little bit here. I think that scientism, the philosophy of scientism, gets smuggled in with our scientific studies. I think about when I was taking courses in evolution and all that as an undergrad, and population genetics and advanced genetics in grad school and everything, there just was a sort of a tacit understanding of a scientism worldview that I'm not just learning about some mechanism of development within the natural realm, but this is like the big picture. So I think it gets smuggled in under the name of science, but it isn't science. It's an unproven philosophy. Well, science, on the contrary to scientism, because science is really the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical world. Science recognizes the physical world, makes observations, and tries to find out and understand the natural laws behind what's happening, and formulate some kinds of theories. I mean, it's a very, well, obviously it's very cool. I mean, but it has a very focused purpose. And science is limited, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just not it's not within the realm of science to answer some of the most important questions in the human life. Some of the biggest questions for humanity that are out there are not in the realm of science and cannot be answered through scientific study. Think of things like this. Who am I? An identity question. How does science answer that? It doesn't. It's not part of the toolkit. Does life have meaning? Is there purpose in life? Do I have a purpose? What is my purpose? What about right and wrong? I just remember in grad school being very, very conflicted about where the line should be drawn, because I was very clear as a science, because my belief in scientism, that there are no lines. It's all culturally constructed. But is there really a right and wrong? I was dissatisfied with my own answers then. What about the issue of justice? Does justice mean anything? And science isn't going to find the answer to that. What about the value of human life? Or who is God? Or how do I relate to God if there is one? Is there a heaven? Is this it? Is this the end of it? I used to think this was the end of it. And is there something after this? There has to be something after this. You have those thoughts. And then, you know, with all that, how would I get there? If there is something, what kind of arrangement do I need to make with a God, if that God is here, to get there after this life? Because I'd like to have more than my 60, 70 to 90 years. I don't want to think that this is the end of it. So I could do wishful thinking, but what about looking into it and seeing if there's real answers? Well, those answers are not going to come from science. Those are not scientific constructions. Those are not scientific arguments. Okay. But this slide, I said that we were going to look at how science and the Bible complement each other. So having ruled out scientism, looked full face at science, so then we just see, what about science? Science describes mechanism. The Bible and God reveal the designer. So it's mechanism and agency. They answer two different questions. I went to a dinner party in Avon, Connecticut with Tad's older sister. And she was in the middle of this crisis in her life, and her shrink told her, you should get your brother and your sister-in-law out here and you should ask them questions about their Christian faith because you need to deal with this and try to come to some kind of faith in God. Her shrink said this. So Tad goes, has all these conversations with her. 2 weeks later, I go, and she's asking a million questions. So I go to this dinner party with her with all these, I don't know, their MDs, whatever they were. And it was interesting because she introduced me as, here's my sister-in-law. She's here because we're talking about Christianity. I'm trying to figure out if I believe in God and if I'm going to do anything about it. I was like, what? So then, you know, the first question, this one guy, older guy, asked me, so how would you, and they also knew I was, you know, had a scientific background. He said, you know, how do you reconcile those two things? And I didn't know how much he wanted to talk, but I just started off by saying, you know, I don't have any conflict between science and the Bible. They ask different questions and they complement one another. And so it did lead to a little more discussion with different people that evening, because a lot of people heard him ask me that question. And I think that's important to know. I'm not saying they're fully exclusive of one another, but there's a fit that happens between science and the Bible. And part of it is because science in general describes mechanisms and the Bible reveals the designer. Science answers questions about how things happen. The Bible and God will answer why things happen. You get the hows and the whys. So for instance, there's this, if it comes up. Wait there. So say I come home and there's this pot of boiling water on the stove. And I say to Tad, I come in and I say, why is that water boiling? And I guess I'm saying it to myself because Tad's got his earphones in or whatever.
I'm here.
Okay, good. Well, when I yell loud enough and he finally hears me, Tad wouldn't do it this way. Okay, I'll say it this way. There are two ways to answer why is that pot of water boiling. One is, because there's heat energy coming from the gas fire there, and it's stirring up the molecules, and when they get hot enough, they're going to be able to have the activation energy to turn into a gas, into water vapor. And the whole thing was, you know, started by turning the knob and letting the gas out and then using the igniters with a spark to flame it. Okay, we could answer it that way. And the other way to do it is just like, Tad put it on to boil. See? So one is the mechanism as to why is that pot on the stove with the water boiling, and one is the agent, the agency. So that could have been answered in two different ways. You know, when you talk to little kids, I was trying to name an example, I don't have it. Often questions happen that way. They'll ask you like a really, really deep question, you think, and they're not really looking for a deep answer. They're just looking for the really simple thing, you know? But anyway, so they answer different questions. Science in the Bible answered different questions. Complimentary. Blah, blah, blah. How about this? There's an article that I picked up, and it's right here, and it's it comes out of Cedars Sinai Hospital System in California. And it's the title of the article is they've been doing some work on the science of kindness. And they're talking about, well, I'll just read a little bit so you have an idea. And then we'll talk about how there's science and God in the Bible are complementary. It reads like this. The warm feeling of well-being that washes over you when you've done something kind isn't just in your head. It's in your brain chemicals. Acts of kindness can release hormones that contribute to your mood and overall well-being. I think we all know this. The practice is so effective, it's being formally incorporated into some types of psychotherapy. And then he has a section there where he talks about how kindness is chemical. Most research on the science behind why kindness makes us feel better has centered around oxytocin, sometimes called the love hormone. Oxytocin plays a role in forming social bonds and trusting other people. Oxytocin is also released when we're physically intimate, whatever. It's tied to making us more trusting, generous, and friendlier while also lowering our blood pressure. Okay, so he's talking about oxytocin, and he goes on and he adds dopamine, that saying when we do random acts of kindness, it releases dopamine, a chemical messenger in the brain that can give us a feeling of euphoria. This feel-good brain chemical is credited with causing what's known as the helper's high. In addition to boosting oxytocin and dopamine, being kind can also increase serotonin, a neurotransmitter that helps us regulate mood. And he goes on, he talks about how kindness is being used as a treatment for pain, depression, and anxiety. So, you know, here we are. That's the mechanism of what happens in our body when we do kind acts. I think everybody here could say you've done some very sweet things from time to time, and it almost makes you feel better than having somebody do something for us, you know, when we do those acts of kindness. Well, what's going on a mechanistic biochemical level is that neurotransmitters and other hormones are being released. And we're getting this profound sense of well-being. So does that mean because, you know, somebody's discovered there are biochemicals in our body that trigger feelings when we do acts of kindness, does that mean that there's no God? No, it's not a proof for there being no God. What it does say is that we are by design wired to love others because the one in whose likeness we're created after is a lover as well. So when he designed us to feel profound sense of well-being when we do random acts of kindness or even intentional acts of kindness. See how they fit together like that? Here is the real reason I am made in the image of God. And so of course, when I act it within my design, I am going to have the senses that he has programmed into my biochemistry. So a pure atheist would say that's a stupid argument. But if you believe in God, you will understand as you see more and more science, there really is this sweet little fit that happens, a complementary relationship between science and the Christian worldview that's found in the Bible. All right, questions. Anybody have any questions or comments or anything at this point?
Oh, hi, Jenny. Abby here.
Oh, hey, Abby.
So when hearing you, I hear a fundamental disagreement with science in the Bible, which is that science is operated under the predication that we know nothing. And you're just trying to figure out what is, right? Whereas the Bible is, we know what the truth is, and we're sort of filling it in from the top down. So I feel like those two different directions can't both be right, you know? Does that make sense?
Hmm. Well, tell me more. Why do you think they can't both be right?
Well, it's sort of like, if, I mean, this isn't like the best, the most cogent way of viewing it, but like when you said that, when you walk in and you see the pot on,
yeah,
you can either understand why it had like all the stuff about, you know, the water molecules being heated up, or you can understand that Tad just turned the stove on.
Yeah.
You don't need to know both of those things at the same time. If you, like, I don't think those two things, like, you can either know, like, you, like, imagine if you're a complete stranger walking into that room.
Okay.
You can either, you know, walk in and be like, oh my God, there's a boiling pot of water here. How did that happen? Or imagine like a caveman does it, right? how did that come to be? What is this magical bubbling happening? Or, you know, you could just say, I believe that someone, you know, decided to turn the flame on. And I don't think that those two things are necessarily parts of the same whole. I think those are two separate avenues, right? They're not really the same thing. Does that make sense?
Yes. They're two explanations, though. There are two different levels of explanation for the event. If you're saying they're both required to be understood, to know what's going on, no, I don't think they're both required. But they certainly are two different ways to explain or describe.
No, I totally agree there are two different ways, but I'm saying that they're, like, how do they...
complement?
I believe that they're two separate, but I don't think that they go together, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah. If you want to get to very careful, the word of complement maybe isn't quite the right word, but that they don't contradict, and they are both two levels of description. But yeah, I do accept that. I was looking for a good word, but complement does seem to make it seem more enmeshed, like something's missing from one explanation that the other thing fits. And I don't think there's anything missing from either of those explanations. Tad turned it on, or the water boiled by this mechanism. So if that's what you're saying,
I'm sorry if I'm being too nitpicky. I don't want to...
No. No, that's the trick in doing this. I'm trying to make it like as clear as possible, but it's not an exact word.
Repeat at some point, right? Like, you think the caveman, if he spent enough time looking at that boiling pot, could be like, you know, a guy named Tad turned the gas on, and this is why.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, I don't know if you ever could, right? I don't think you could ever have science go up all the way to tell you that a guy named Tad did this.
Yeah, right. It'd be two different levels of explanation, and one may not be accessible. Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
So, I'm being brought up in this conversation, you know, if I did not turn on the pot, we could explain like the physical reaction, like what's happening there. But then there'd still be a question about like, why? what was the agency? What was the cause of this physical reaction of boiling water? And if I'm not there, we're left with.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm not claiming to be God for the cause of all things, but yeah.
But I'm just saying like there's no expectation that science could ever tell you that, right? The science can like that's again, it's a different level. There's no bridging that gap.
Totally agree.
Right. Yes.
Hey, Jeff here. I guess the way I would think of it maybe is when you talk about science, it's like if somebody made a copy machine and they knew everything about it, and then Abhi, you walked in and you started to discover things about electronics as you looked at the copy machine. So you're discovering their genius as you look at it and take it apart and test it and that sort of thing. I think that's kind of another aspect of this, that if God really... if it's possible that he did create, then what science is about in part is discovering the wonder of this creation. Is another, and that's not coming at the cause of it and more the existential, but it's more like the physical. If he set all this in motion, part of science is discovering the wonder of what he made.
good. Any other thoughts or anything you want to throw in on that, anybody?
Does the word cohesive make any more sense than complementary? Because you could almost fit them in a sentence together to the point where they're not contradictory. I don't know if that's more helpful, but that's just the way I like to think of it. Like, Tad put this put the pod on, and all this other stuff started to happen the other way around.
Yeah. That could work. Just whatever we can get that's closest to say not contradictory, because that really is the objection with a lot of things. That people think if there's a contradiction, so I was trying not to be negative. Because I'm just this positive person anyway.
I have a question that doesn't have to do with boiling pots. So as we are looking at like 16th and 17th century, that's when science was created and a lot of the first scientists were Christians and they're using it to study God's creation. And I was hoping that we'd get to what, because nowadays it's like you can either culture thinks, not all culture, but a lot of times it's like, I either believe in science or God. And like, there's just this big divide. Yeah. And so I'm curious, it's like, we were at a point where like a lot of the, you know, first scientists were Christians, but now we see that a lot of scientists are atheists. So where did that divide happen and why? Maybe you don't know the answers, but I was curious as to like why it seems like they're, you know, pitted against each other now in our culture.
Hmm.
Or like the process of how that got there. Maybe you don't know that. I don't know.
Well, a lot of, I mean, the culture has gone away from, I mean, has been, we're not in the 16th and 17th century culture. We're a post-Christian culture. So people are going to be products of their culture. I also think just from my own experience, there is a, there's something that happens in the sciences that where this scientism gets smuggled in. And so it's a much narrower view of the world. And at least for me, there was a lot of pride in that, that, you know, I found me, I as a scientist know more than other people. I understand the real plan, you know, that there is no plan. So.
As a scientific agnostic, if definitely not a scientific atheist, I think science as a craft is like the opposite of faith-based, right? It's extremely evidentiary. And I think that doesn't mesh well, I think, sometimes with faith, in the sense that faith requires you to suspend your disbelief and really not that you don't have a burden of proof, but rather that you're not like, I think it's just a different, like it breeds a different way of looking at the world that I think is not necessarily, doesn't gel well with faith as a whole.
Yeah, we will.
Okay, so like the idea of like having to take a leap of faith or believe in something that isn't measurable doesn't seem like you can measure it the way. Okay, that makes sense.
No, we take baby steps, right? We don't take leaps. We inch towards discoveries. We never say, let's go to 100, right?
Right. Good discussion. That sounds like a lot more could happen in that discussion. That's good. All right, we got to go back to this though. The time is ticking. All right, I'm gonna look at two apparent contradictions. I'm not gonna go super deep in this, but we will look at two apparent contradictions between science and the Bible. So here's one, the origin of the universe. There is a contradiction in this sense, an apparent contradiction. The Bible teaches that the universe had a beginning. And, you know, right from the first pages of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it's talking about the beginning, not one of many beginnings or anything, but before anything, God created the heavens and the earth. And so when we're talking about the universe, the origin of the universe, we're talking about space and time, way back in the beginning. So there's the biblical position. And science has historically, at least in my lifetime, had two different theories. When I was in junior high, there were both theories were on the table and presented as almost equal theories. The one that where I lived, and according to the text that my science teacher used and her personal bias, they really pushed the fact that the universe had already existed, but there's this new theory called the Big Bang. which says that the universe had a beginning. Well, the universe always existed. It was a really cool picture that there was this oscillating universe that would expand and eventually collapse on itself. And then some people called it the big bounce, where it bounced back and go back to expansion. And it had been doing that for really basically ever. But the newer idea was the Big Bang, which now I find out wasn't as new as my science class and text indicated. Turns out the research is behind the Big Bang in very substantial ways. One is the fact that when it was discovered that there was this red shift as you look to the outer galaxies and stuff, and it means that the universe is expanding, and the outer galaxies are expanding even faster. And so, you know, taking that back to the beginning, there had to be a beginning for it to be constantly expanding. So you bring it all the way back and you said the universe had a beginning, and it was probably, what, 13.7 billion years ago, whatever. And then what else did I want to say with that expansion of the universe? Oh, and so here's the deal. This is what happened. And this is why I think in 1970, whatever that was, they really didn't give us all the information about the Big Bang. Because by the time I was in junior high, they should have changed the textbooks to say it really, all the evidence is pointing toward the Big Bang. And even more recently, they have found all these other things they speculate should be around to prove that, like stray radiation and stuff. So, but the scientific community there were hesitations in accepting it, because like Hawking would say, he said that it smacked of a creator, and scientists didn't want to hear that. So that's maybe the political side of science. I didn't know about that as a kid, but right now it is pretty clear the universe had a beginning. I mean, really close to, it's a strong theory. I'm going to go to this. It's interesting because, let me see if I have anything else I want to say there. We're seeing the Bible with the Big Bang. We're seeing a convergence there, something that, going from the theory that the universe always existed, that definitely contradicted the Bible for a long time. But now we've got the explanation that the universe had a beginning. And it is accepted by the scientific community for the most part. And it was interesting because this author made a comment that I thought was really insightful. He said, "For the scientist who's lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He's scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." So there's, you know, this, what's happened is the facts have pointed to a starting point for the universe. I don't understand why Christians, some think the Big Bang is not true because somehow it disparages God as being the creator of the universe. I think it's exactly a convergence between the Big Bang and what's written in the Bible. So, and obviously the scientific community recognizes that too. So there's one apparent contradiction that really I don't believe is a contradiction. Big Bang, if they find out that there was something before the Big Bang, it wouldn't shake my faith in God. I believe that he still is the creator, and that just means that the Big Bang, if there was a prior mechanism to that, but nothing before that, God is the one ultimately that created the universe. So I got no problem if there ends up being some other little piece to this, like it was compressed energy or something. Okay. One more contradiction. One, God created life on earth. The Bible says God made the wild animals according to their kinds and livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds, and saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. So the text in the book of Genesis says that God was the creator of life. And kind of the why, you know, I want to make mankind in my own image, and I'm going to give him the opportunity to express benevolent rulership and take care of this planet and have a relationship with him. As you go on in Genesis, it becomes very clear that God created this universe and this earth in particular to have a relationship with people made in his image and experience the beauty of his creation. So here's the apparent contradiction. Evolution, okay. Everything evolved. I think, well, let me see what I have here. Let's read first. Plants, animals, and other living things on earth have their origin in other pre-existing types, and that the distinguishable differences are due to modifications in successive generations. And I think still people hold to part of the Darwinian theory of survival of the fittest, that the organisms are designed toward modification toward being more suited to their environment, but always about a million years late, whatever. These are complementary, and for these reasons. One, the focus of the Genesis account isn't to describe the mechanism of what God did in his creation. The focus really is to describe the why. Yes, there is some how, but it is clearly because he made this creation because he wanted to. He is a creator God, and he made mankind and the creation too because he wanted to show love and kindness toward his creation. I mean, that's super clear as you read the book of Genesis. It is not a scientific text. It does make some statements, obviously, that God is a creator. And Christians, Bible-believing Christians, have many ways, not many, probably two or three ways, they differ on how they interpret the Old Testament text. And, you know, it could vary from God had created episodes where he stepped in and introduced new species. Others believe that he guided the evolutionary process. I think the one thing you really have to land on is that humankinds are made actually in the image of God and they have a spirit. So however God did that, I got some friends I really respect believe that God uses evolutionary process and then stepped in and gave mankind the spirit at some point. It's an interesting, there's lots of ways to be respectful of the text of the Bible and believe in evolution. I mean, I do believe that plants and animals do evolve. Whether I think they go from species to species, I think they could. I don't have it all worked out, but I certainly would never say that I don't think evolutionary processes don't work. I think there's definitely evolution at work. So I believe these fit together. And a lot of people have concluded that as well. But I will say evolution, the idea of evolution just in general, for an atheist in particular, can really be a barrier to faith in God. I know I came out to, you know, like a home church like this for a long time. And I would have to say that it really stuck in me because I thought it's either evolution or there's a God, because evolution makes it so there doesn't need to be a God, and the Bible teaches there's a God. I guess that was my sticking point around being a convinced Christian early on. But Tad brought something up to me that I had not ever considered. And that was, and this is the only statement he made. We didn't go into detail about what I believed about evolution, but he did say, you understand that some parts of evolution take faith. And like, I was a little bit dumbfounded because what was flashing through my head was the origins, the life from non-life. I've seen the Miller experiments. I've been to the Museum of Natural History. I hear about the prebiotic soup. I understand about panspermia, all these different ways of explaining how life came from non-life in the beginning. And I knew, even as an atheist scientist, that there's a lot of hand waving in there. Like, we don't know, you know? And there's been a lot of hand waving for a long time. And you know, whether, I wasn't even saying, well, science will never find out. But I was saying, and I realized what I was doing. I was holding to the fact that I'm a scientist. I don't do faith. And then to hear that my belief in the foundations of the evolutionary model is just faith, pure faith, that sometime science will figure it out. That really bothered me. It really bothered me to think that that my understandings of the world and in evolution it has a position of faith at the very foundation. So that kind of opened me up a little bit. And I realized that that I did live a life that had faith. And in fact, I just bought a book by Norm Geisler, and it's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And some of it's good, some of it's just a lot of words. But that was the thing that kind of broke through to me, that even skeptics are expressing faith in something. And then this belief in evolution does take faith. So I stand on this side and I see those can fit together. I'm not saying I know exactly how the mechanism of evolution fit into the creation, but I know that it happens and I know that God created. And so I've got some, my own ideas of how they work together. But I think that would be up, you know, for you guys, that, you know, when you come to faith in Christ or whatever, that's something you really need to look into. There's a lot of things you can read. There's a lot of opinion. It's probably good to land on something, have some sort of idea of what might be the way that brings us together. But they're not tacitly contradictory. So. All right. So I think it's time for questions, if you have any more. Do you? Comments? Questions? It's a pretty fast pass over the material, and over, you're just touching on things that have a lot more out there to read.
Jenny, you could stop sharing so we can look at each other while we think of questions.
Oh, good job. Never thought of that. Thank you.
Okay, sorry, I have one last question. Is this the end? Is it over? Because I don't want to like take up too much time if I have one more question.
It's over.
Okay. What would be like, if this is something that we wanted to look into more, what would be like one or two or 10 resources that would be good to point towards? Does that make sense? Like a book that was helpful for you with reading or with studying out this, or just something that's been helpful. Does that question make sense?
Yeah. There's sections of books that I think are really good. You know what? I'm going to throw that out to other people, because I bet some of you guys have read some things that you really like. Let's do it there first.
Can you repeat that question, Jenny?
Any books she could read on this topic.
Or just any, I don't know. Sometimes you hear stuff about this and you actually want to like go and read more and not, I don't know. Just like, okay.
I don't know. Okay, cool.
Okay. Well, you know, I'd have to say Tim Keller has some decent stuff on this that is pretty accessible. You've got a Strobel book that's reasonable, where he's interviewed some people. It's not great. And anything by John Lennox. And I think he's got some really good online debates, even with like Richard Dawkins, and he had some with Hawking before he died. And they were friends at Oxford, Hawking and Lennox. Lennox is nice because he's not this inflammatory guy that's like shouting bad things at other people. He's really respectful, and he's got some wisdom. I like listening to him on these topics. One of the books I read a long time ago that I really like is called Darwin's Black Box. It talks about irreducible complexity, and, you know, uses the example of a mousetrap. Unless you have all the features of a mousetrap, it's not going to work. So there's a complexity in things like the way that, you know, the cascade of biochemicals in our eye work, that if you don't have all the pieces, then you don't have a functioning mechanism that can then be subject to natural selection, see which is the better eye or what's the better mousetrap. You've got this complexity. The thing doesn't work till you have all the parts. So how can you say it evolved by natural selection? So I like that book a lot. But you know, lately, it's been more Lennox I've been listening to and reading his stuff. I think it's quite decent. I think C.S. Lewis, anything that he does that touches on morality, because that was a massive argument for me as well too. It was a resolution after I came to Christ, reading some of C.S. Lewis's stuff on we have a moral impulse for justice and love because it's designed, and you can't really get that out of a worldview that doesn't have a God. You can have social constructs, but you're not going to have any real morality. We all kind of know that, you know. So those would be some. I could get together a better list if you want.
I have one last question too. Last one, I promise. I'd asked Zach this, and I don't think we ever came to a resolution. So I think the idea that God made us in his image is another thing that I don't think reconciles well with science at all, because I think if you're a scientist or a biologist like me, you believe that everybody plays by the same rules. You know, we all, as evolutionary biologists, you believe that we descended from animals, right? Like, we're not separate from them. We're the same as, like, we operate in the same mechanism the dog does. Yeah. So how do you sort of explain that? Because that's a central tenet of Christianity, right? Right? We are the ones with souls. We're the ones that go to heaven. We're the ones made in God's image. How can you explain that?
Well, it is a given. That'd be one thing. It's a given. There's not a lot of argument and lots of detail on it. I guess I would ask the opposite question. How do you get to the point of saying that a human life has value if it's really just a product of, which some people call mindless evolution, and there really is no inherent value in human life? Why can't we just take a human life? It is survival of the fittest. Why do we have this internal thing that I shouldn't do that? I think it flips that way, really. So that's what I'd do. So the fact that we are made in the image of God is really something that is accessed by God's revelation. And like, he really did speak. There's evidence scripturally that he, and in history, that he spoke. And so that's something, that part of it got revealed directly from God without a big argument. But I still don't know how a evolutionary biologist would hold to the value of human life. I step on ants and kill them every day, but I wouldn't step on my aunt and kill her. So.
But I think that animals do that too, or some of them do at least, right? Cannibalism. Sure. Is not something that's common in the animal world.
Right.
For the most part.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I don't know. That's just an objection.
I think it's worth thinking about. You know?
I would like to add something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, hi everyone. My name is Janelle. I am currently in like the neuroscience PhD program at Pitt, and I just love neuroscience. I love everything about the brain. And so, Jenny, when you were talking about neurotransmitters and oxytocin and all that stuff, like I was like, oh yes, oh yes. This is it. But I wanted to just add that last semester before, like, I graduated from college and everything was, like, pre-corona, I was in a neuroethics course, and we did have, like, a conversation, a roundtable conversation about, like, dualism, like, the mind and whether everything is like mechanical, like nuts and bolts, and if there's neurotransmitters to explain everything, mm-hmm. or if there's something beyond this just mechanical making of our brain, yeah. like consciousness and things like that. Yeah. And so we went around, and our professor, she didn't want us to explain, but she just wanted to hear what everyone had to say. And there was like a mixture of answers. But everyone around the table who I knew believed in or had some type of faith, we all agree that like the brain is more than just the like biology, especially when it comes to like consciousness, because there's definitely something that we know we cannot explain. And we haven't even tapped into it, like, at all. We have not scratched the surface. And I think, like, that the fact that we don't know is, like, it just reaffirms my faith in some type of way. Like, it's just reassuring to know, like, God's, like, creation and the way he made us and the way he made our brains to function and all of his abilities and, like, the way we're able to, like, daydream and dream and think before we act and all those, like, things that come from more so, like, morality, I would say, they just, like, reassure that there are some things that just cannot be explained scientifically, or God isn't ready for us to understand those things scientifically, because I believe everything that everyone's ever theorized has come from some thought that some type of spirit has put on someone's mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I think now as scientists, because we have proved, and I quote prove, we prove so many theories that we think we know, and so there's no reason to have to sit and really come up with things like out of the blue, because we have so much concrete information that we're able to run with. Yeah. We kind of feel like we know it all, so yeah. But there is like I have faith in the unknown, I guess. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just wanted to add that because I love the brain.
That's great. I think that's really good. And there is a stability that happens when you know, I may not know the mechanism for consciousness. Maybe it will be discovered, but it doesn't make me think there's no God. I just know he's given us a mind to read and discover his blueprint. The time that gets people get in trouble, because there are some Christians that believe in this God of the gaps, you know, kind of like the Greeks didn't understand thunder, so they made up a God. The God was angry and clapped things together, and there was thunder. So I think some Christians do that with science sometimes to their peril, because when there becomes a mechanism, then science discovers a mechanism, they're like, oh, and you know, that refutes your belief in God or whatever. But I like your position, because you're like, there may be answers, but I also know there's an agent outside of this, and I'm made in his image, and I have consciousness that's valuable because
he does. So I like that. It's really cool.
So I've always been really interested in like Homo sapiens and like the evolutions of specifically humans. Yeah. So would you say that, I don't know, does the Bible contradict that idea, or could it complement? I don't know. I've always wondered that.
Yeah, you would probably need an interpreter.
Oh, you guys can hear me. Okay.
Can you guys speak in electronic? you gonna type it?
Okay, I was going to ask, so I've always wondered specifically about, like, human evolution, and, like, if the Bible supports the idea of, like, Homo sapiens evolving from, like, this earlier species, like, I don't know.
That's where some of the different opinions come in. Like, it depends on where your position is, whether you think God intervened on evolution and brought it and introduced a spirit into beings at certain part in their development, or whether or not God just stepped in and made humankind. There's different views on that. I don't know if they're all equally good, but for me, whenever I know anybody that's taking a more recent anthropology course, I'm always asking, when do they have the first evidence of people being buried with stuff? That would show an indication that being understood there was life after death. So I'm always like trying to find that out. You know, it could be 40,000 years ago, it could be 100,000. I don't know for sure, but I'm always watching that in terms of archaeology and anthropology. When did that understanding about there is a God, when did that start? And for me, just as a rule of thumb, that's sort of helpful for me to know when perhaps the first beings made in the image of God arrived. So. Okay, I just got this from Tad, which is what he does when I teach. You know what I mean? I'm leaving you guys here too long. anybody else got one last comment, maybe? These are really good questions and comments.
Can I add one sort of musing?
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, Jenny. I really loved what you had to say about the Big Bang and then immediately following into evolution there. My brain went to, I don't know if anybody else is a big fan of Cosmos, but like the first episode, they talk about Big Bang to present day being a calendar year and humanity showing up like fraction of the last second.
Yeah.
And I just started thinking about that, and with the conversation of we are made in God's image, it's so interesting to think about him coming in at what for humanity is the last second.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so recently for us coming in and injecting that spirit, was a really nice way that you said that. I just think that's so interesting. And like I said, this is just amusing, not really a question, but I think about that a lot, how humanity is so small if we do recognize the Big Bang as the full length of time, and how important we seem to be in the story of the Bible and to God.
It is. Wow, that's cool. Thanks for saying that. That's how you put it together too. That's very cool. Thanks. All right, we're done. That's it. We'll see ya. Rest up, John.
Thanks, Jenny.
Yeah, it was fun. Bye.
Thanks, Jenny.
Yeah. Great conversation.
Yeah, it was great.
I love you.
I love you. I love you back.
Me?
No, whoever.
Johnny.
Hi, I love you, John.
I love you, Johnny.
I love you.
All right. We're
going to
go.
You're not going to ask Ted's question? Ted, what was your mystery question? Or did you tell her to end it?
It was time. It was time.
Bryn, you should probably go because you're still breaking up.
Gordy was texting me and chatting these things. Stop, stop, stop.
Sorry. Why? At some point, does it get bad?
Don't want the expectation to be that it always runs long and you should always be prepared for like half an hour extra, I guess. That's what I would assume.
Not make it go super long.
Right.
Oh, Riley with the super cool freaking.
Seems very thoughtful.
Amusing.
But Dad, I guess that means we should just leave because then we all live together. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Because then we live together.